Kellerman, NPR News, Ramallah.
Pope Benedict has arrived in Scotland, first stop on an historic four-day visit to Britain. Speaking to reporters during the flight there, the Pope acknowledged that the Roman Catholic Church failed to act quickly or decisively enough to deal with priests who have abused children. He said the Church's top priority now is helping the victims of abuse. The Pope was greeted by Queen Elizabeth at her Scottish palace.
We are all aware of the special contribution of the Roman Catholic Church, particularly in its ministry to the poorest and most deprived members of society.
The Queen is head of the Church of England, which split from the Roman Catholic Church back in the 16th century, a split that was followed by centuries of anti-Catholic sentiment in Britain. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
John Paul and his guest, retired U of I professor George Friedman, take you on a trip back in history to the days when streetcars were the way to get around town. Back then, the interurban railway made it easy to travel from city to city in central Illinois. Watch Illinois Pioneers, 7:30 p.m., Thursday, September 23rd, on WILL-TV.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning telephone talk program. David Inge is away. I'm Tom Rogers. If you ask about the turning point in the history of gay rights in America, the first answer you may get would be the uprising outside the Stonewall Inn in 1969 in Manhattan after that bar was raided by police who had regularly rounded up patrons, possibly for just being gay. That was one high-profile moment in the movement. But many of the other moments that shaped the progress of rights for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people took place inside the nation's courtrooms. It was a major part of the movement. And today we'll talk about a book that outlines some of the biggest cases. Rutgers University law professor Carlos Ball has taken a close look at five cases he says have had the biggest impact on the question of gay rights. His book is entitled From the Closet to the Courtroom, Five LGBT Rights Lawsuits That Have Changed Our Nation. And Carlos Ball joins us on Focus this morning from Spain. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
What brings you to Spain?
I am actually on sabbatical from my university, and my partner has a Fulbright to do legal research here. So I am here with him and also writing a new book.
So I should say good afternoon.
It is afternoon, that's right.
Let's talk about the cases that you've chosen for the book. Actually, you start in the introduction with a separate case that, I guess, in another way, sort of begins the process of the gays and lesbians standing up, a case involving a hotel in Austin that had a disco, and decided that it was illegal to for men to dance with men and women to dance with women. And there is a small group of people that decided to test that, and that case spawned a legal case and went on from there.
That's right. This was a disco in Austin, Texas, that for some reason decided, in part, I guess, because there were some gay members of the community that were patronizing it, to institute a no same-sex dancing policy. And so that when same-sex couples started dancing together, they would be approached by members of the staff and essentially asked to either stop dancing together or to leave the premises. This happened in 1979. It so happened that 2 years before, the city of Austin had enacted an ordinance, which was still unusual in those days, that prohibited places of public accommodation from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. So after the disco, the owners of the disco implemented this policy, some gay and lesbian college students from the University of Texas decided to visit the establishment one night. They started dancing as opposite-sex couples, they switched in the middle of a song to same-sex couples. They were approached and asked to leave, and they did. But they then contacted lawyers and decided to sue the establishment, and eventually the case went to a jury. And a jury decided that the establishment had, in fact, violated the local ordinance. The owners were only fined $200, so it was not a huge penalty. But the point was made, and that is that if you are a place of public accommodation in the city of Austin, you cannot discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation.
So this was the first time where one of those laws had actually been enforced.
It was one of the very first times. I'm not sure that it was the first time, but it was one of the very early cases, yes.
On the other hand, things like that could still happen today in places that don't have those ordinances in place.
Absolutely. There are literally thousands of municipalities throughout the United States that do not have such laws. And there are 29 states that do not have anti-discrimination protection at the state level. So, yes, absolutely. That could still happen in a lot of places in the country.
So you go from that case into the five maybe more momentous cases, the ones that in legal terms probably had the most impact on what we have today in our country and nationwide. And before I go on, let me mention that the phone lines are open. This is a call-in program, and if you want to have questions you want to ask to Carlos Ball, our numbers are 333-9455 in the local calling area. Toll-free, you can get us at 1-800-222-9455. By some strange quirk of technology, we don't have the email address open for us today, but phone lines are still open and ready for your calls. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. The first case you talk about in this book is another case from dating back from the early 80s and the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And yeah, as we'll find out later, the AIDS crisis and the movement for rights was intertwined in that time. And it's not a case that we hear about, but it did set the precedent for a lot of things to come. And the case was called Brasky versus Stahl Associates. It was nothing you wouldn't on the surface have thought it was something momentous in that time, because it had to do with the sometimes dry case of rent control in New York City. But it did set a precedent. Explain a little about the background of this case.
Sure. Mr. Brasky had been living with his same-sex partner in an apartment in New York City in Manhattan for 10 years. His partner, Leslie Blanchard, was the person who was actually the named tenant in the lease. Mr. Blanchard died in 1986 of AIDS-related complications. And since this was a rent-control apartment, the landlord, under the applicable regulations, wanted to essentially free the apartment from those regulations. And so he quickly moved, after Mr. Blanchard died, to evict Mr. Brasky. There was a regulation in place that protected family members from eviction, family members, that is, of the named tenant on the lease. And Mr. Brasky, in 1986, claimed legally that he was a family member of Mr. Blanchard. They had been together for 10 years. They had an emotionally and economic interdependent relationship, to put it in somewhat legal terms. And he argued in court that he was entitled to the anti-eviction protection provided by the New York regulation. The case went all the way up to the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York. And in 1989, that court held for the first time in the nation's history that two men in a committed relationship could, in fact, be deemed a family, and that, therefore, Mr. Brasky was entitled to the anti-eviction protection afforded by the regulation.
And this was the first time. This was well before the topic of gay marriage really even came to the forefront, or people had thought about that even among the gay community. And you mentioned this as a theme during the book, is that a lot of people who were working on gay rights in the legal profession wanted to take things gradually.
That's absolutely correct. In the 1980s, there were very few people in the organized gay rights movement who were thinking about marriage as a realistic civil rights goal. Instead, as I argue in the book, movement leaders, including lawyers within the movement, were pursuing what was very much a gradualist approach. And the Brashi case that I just described to you is an example of that gradualist approach. You don't go for the full ball of wax. You take these rights one at a time. What ended up happening, and this is a case that I talked about later in the book, is that some couples in Hawaii decided to seek marriage licenses, really pretty much on their own, without the support of the organized gay rights movement. This happened in 1990. Mm-hmm. And they were, of course, they showed up and asked for their marriage licenses, and they were, of course, turned down. The couples then went to the ACLU. They went to the Lambda Legal Defense Fund, which is one of the leading legal gay rights advocacy organizations in the country. And while those groups were sympathetic to the couple's predicament, they did not think that it was realistic to expect courts to mandate same-sex marriage. So the couples ended up hiring a local civil rights lawyer who litigated the case in Hawaii. And in 1993, the Hawaii Supreme Court issued a ruling in which it questioned the constitutionality of denying same-sex couples the ability to marry. And it was that really largely, at the time, unexpected ruling that got the equality, the marriage equality movement going.
And it also got some of those organizations like the ACLU, which maybe were a little hesitant to pick it up, to think of it as a realistic option.
That's absolutely correct. It's an interesting example of movement activists and lawyers in some ways following the community as opposed to the other way around. There were some members of the LGBT community in the early 1990s who were thinking about marriage and who thought that it was an achievable goal. And, you know, here we are, of course, 20 years later with marriage and same-sex marriage in several jurisdictions in the United States.
So the Brashi case we were talking about earlier with the what denotes a family, how far did that go in setting out the definition of family? Because you would think that, you know, a wide legal ruling or a wide legal interpretation of that would in effect maybe pave the way for gay marriage at that time.
Yeah, it's very interesting because the lawyers in the Brashi case, and that case was an ACLU case, mm-hmm. The ACLU lawyers in that case had an interesting legal strategic decision to make early on. Because the regulation protected not only family members, but also spouses. So the regulation said spouses and family members of the named rent control tenant cannot be evicted as long as they were living with the tenant for a considerable period of time prior to the death of the named tenant. So there was one possibility was to argue that Mr. Brashi was in fact Mr. Blanchard's spouse. The problem with that line of attack and reasoning was that the word spouse legally has a very specific definition and does, in fact, require a marriage license. The word family, on the other hand, is more open-ended, both as a matter of the regular use of the word and also legally. The regulation did not define family, so what Mr. Brashi and his lawyers argued was that the court should adopt a functional definition of family.
And it was that broad definition of family that didn't include blood, adoption, that sort of thing,
exactly.
Marriage, that paved the way for this.
That's exactly right. So the landlord in the Brashi case said, now wait a minute, you can't define family. You can't be a family member unless there is a connection by either marriage, adoption, or blood. That's the only way in which we can legally define family. And the court said, Well, no, wait a minute. Those are some of the ways, but Mr. Blanchard and Mr. Brashi have been there, were there for each other for over 10 years. They considered themselves to be a family. They were considered by their friends and family members to be a familial unit. And the court in the end said we have to be realistic. We have to look at the way in which individuals actually carry out their daily lives in determining what is a family, as opposed to applying these rigid, formalistic legal definitions.
Carlos Ball is our guest on Focus this morning. His book is From the Closet to the Courtroom, Five LGBT Rights Lawsuits That Have Changed Our Nation. I'm Tom Rogers. It's Focus, and your calls are welcome at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 on the issues of gay rights. And our email address is now available if you want to send an email rather than give a call. Our address is will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. The second case that you talk about after the Brashi case, the foundation of that took place around the time that the Brashi case was decided, I believe, correct?
That is
correct.
It was
a little bit later, involving harassment. A teenager who was openly gay had been tormented through a lot of his time in middle school and high school. And unlike many cases where bullying, you know, cases aren't necessarily reported, he reported it, did not get a lot of reaction from the principals in the schools, and wound up pursuing the case in court.
That's right. This is wasn't, and to some extent still is, an endemic problem in America's schools, and that is the harassment. Peer-on-peer harassment of LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender students. Mr. Nabozny, who was when this all started, he was a kid. He was in the seventh grade, as you mentioned. Spent many years literally being terrorized at his school, and when he did complain, the school officials either said things like, you know, boys will be boys, and his attackers were exclusively boys. Boys will be boys. That's just the way these kids are.
They just pick on each other. That's
the
way things go.
They just pick on each other. Yeah. And sometimes they actually said to Jamie, well, the problem is that you are too obviously gay. It's your fault. Be a little less openly gay, and you will run into fewer problems. Now, the important point to emphasize about Jamie's case is that we're not talking about words that hurt his feelings only. We're talking about a level of physical harassment and that was quite severe. I mean, he was punched, he was kicked, he was urinated on. At one point, he was held down, and some of the other boys faked a rape of him. Really pretty atrocious stuff. And it's quite clear that any school administrator in the country today, and even back then, if Jamie had been a girl, they would not have tolerated that kind of conduct. They would have, one would hope, put an end to it very quickly.
And that's the case that they had made in court, was that they did have case histories, including against a couple of the kids, or at least one of the kids that had been involved in picking on Jamie Nabozny, was that he was also punished much less so, or much more so, I guess, for saying a word, a nasty word to his girlfriend.
That's right. So the gist of the legal claim when Jamie took his case to court was that the school district and the school administrators had violated his constitutional rights to equal protection, that they treated Jamie differently, both because he was a boy and because he was gay, and that they here are the school administrators. Now, this case did start in the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. There was a U.S. Supreme Court case still in the books then, decided in 1986, called Bowers versus Hardwick, in which the court ruled that states could criminalize same-sex sexual conduct. That case, as we can talk about later in the hour if
right.
you want, ended up being overruled by the Supreme Court.
And you'll eventually talk about that in one of the five cases.
That's right. But that was the law of the land at the time that Jamie brought his lawsuit. The school administrators and their lawyers argued, I think in hindsight, incredibly, really, that that case meant that there was no constitutional right to be protected on the basis of sexual orientation. That is, essentially, they argued that Jamie could be treated differently because he was gay by school officials, especially when the school officials themselves were not harassing him, right? The claim was that they were not stopping the other kids from physically and verbally harassing him. So that was the argument that they made. And the appellate court in that case, an intermediate appellate court from Illinois, sitting in Chicago, ruled that that's not the case, that even though Bowers versus Hardwick was still in the books, that the state could, in fact, criminalize intimate sexual conduct of gay people, that had nothing to do with what happened in Jamie's case. And that was that he was treated differently, or at least that was the allegation. He was treated differently because he was gay. The case ended up going to trial after that legal ruling. A jury in rural Wisconsin concluded that, in fact, the school administrators violated Jamie's rights under the federal constitution. They were about to impose liability when the school decided to settle the case for almost $1 million.
And it's that possibility of liability and the successful lawsuit there on behalf of Jamie Nabazi that has led to changes in policy that are still going on today.
Absolutely. You know, I've talked to the lawyers who were involved in these issues back in the 1990s, and they told me that the difference between what was happening before Jamie's case and what happened after was like night and day. So when they would get complaints from different parts of the country that gay kids were being harassed in particular public schools, before Jamie's case, they would call the school administrators on the phone, and the school administrators, for the most part, would not even take their calls. After Jamie's case, right, after word got around that there was potential liability from a failure to protect gay kids in schools from harassment, school administrators started paying attention to the issue, began doing the right thing much more frequently, instituting policies to make sure that that kind of unacceptable behavior did not take place.
From there, you go into the three cases that probably, you know, people remember the most, perhaps, that made the biggest headlines in the regular news, including one involving a constitutional amendment that was voted on in Colorado that not only you can explain a little bit about what Amendment 2 was all about, but it was fairly harsh in the way that it treated existing gay rights laws up to that point in Colorado, and then tried to make them to forbid those kinds of laws in the future.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've forgotten now because we've been paying so much attention to other gay issues, including same-sex marriage,
right.
But in the early 1990s, it became common for conservative groups in some states in the country that allow the enactment of laws and of constitutional amendments via the ballot to propose ballot initiatives that essentially would prohibit state and local governments from enacting anti-discrimination laws and ordinances that protected gay people from discrimination. Now, the interesting thing about these proposals was that they essentially, if you want to put it in the most simplistic way, and this is the way in which the Supreme Court ended up really looking at the case, they essentially picked on gay people, right? So in Colorado, before this ballot initiative was approved by the voters, and even after it, you could enact a law that protected individuals on the basis of discrimination on any grounds, not only the ones that we're familiar with, such as race and religion, but others that we're perhaps less familiar with, I'll give you an example. In Colorado, there was a law at the time that protected smokers from being discriminated by employers. So an employee could not be fired because he or she smoked at home.
Huh.
But after the enactment of the approval by voters, by a small margin, but nonetheless a majority, the Colorado Constitution would have said, if a lawsuit had not been successful, that the state, neither the state nor the local governments, can enact any laws that protect gay people from discrimination.
And that, the way that was worded actually sort of formed the basis for the challenge to that amendment when it was challenged in court.
I mean, that's right. And interestingly enough, and I think in hindsight, if the drafters of the ballot initiative could do it all over again, they would probably draft it differently. They would remove from the state and local governments the authority to enact anti-discrimination laws on the basis of sexual orientation, right? Because if you word it that way, that means that both gays and straights are ineligible to protection under the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that would have passed constitutional muster, but it would have been an easier ballot initiative to defend in the courts.
Have there been laws that are written in that way that have provided cover for that?
One of the interesting things about this case, and the name of the case is Roma versus Evans.
Right.
It was decided by the Supreme Court in 1996.
And it was overturned. The amendment was overturned.
The amendment was overturned. One of the interesting effects of that opinion was that it really delegitimized this entire effort on the part of anti-gay rights activists to use the ballot as a way of depriving lesbians and gay men of anti-discrimination protection under the laws. So, of course, anti-gay rights activists have been using the ballot on the issue of marriage since. But they decided, I think, smartly, strategically, that they needed to focus on other issues. The gay rights victory in Roe versus Evans was so clear. The court was so adamant in ruling that gay people have constitutional rights to be treated as equal citizens in our society, something which the Supreme Court had never said before, that they moved on, and so they did not attempt the type of wider or the type of ballot initiative that would have had a wider effect, such as the one we were talking about earlier.
And as we know now, a lot of that attention on opponents of gay rights went to the issue of same-sex marriage, which you brought up in the fourth case that we've talked about before with the couples in Hawaii that had attempted to get a marriage license, were denied, and then took their cases to court. What has happened since then? And constitutional amendments have been written that way since then, you know, taking note of Roe versus Evans, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, the Roe versus Evans ruling, you know, spoke to really that issue, specifically that issue of whether you can deprive the state, or whether the people through the ballot box can deprive the state of the authority to enact these anti-discrimination laws. The focus has in fact now shifted to marriage, there have been many ballot initiatives that have been approved by voters in many states, which essentially amend the Constitution, the state constitutions, and say the equality principle, the equality provision in this Constitution, does not apply to the issue of marriage, right? That it is not a violation of equal protection under state constitutional law to deny gay people to marry. And you know, once you change the state constitution in that way, from a gay rights perspective, there are really only two possibilities. One is to try to convince the voters of the state to rescind that constitutional provision. Mm-hmm. That's option number one. Option number two is to argue that the state constitutional provision approved by the voters violates the federal constitution, which is, of course, what's been going on in California recently with a Proposition 8 litigation there.
And that has been something that's been in the news in the past few weeks since the release of your book, that had been overturned. There's been, a temporary restraining order to not allow marriages at the moment in California. But how did that case rely on the previous cases that you mentioned in your book to get to that conclusion?
Yeah, well, you know, there are the principle of equality that the court recognized in Romer versus Evans transfers to the issue of marriage, right? Because what the court in Romer versus Evans, which was the Colorado Amendment 2 case, what the court ruled there was essentially that you need a rational reason. You need a reason that passes a rationality test when you enact laws that distinguish between gay people and straight people. And Amendment 2, the court in Romer versus Evans held, does not pass that rationality test. In many ways, that's what has been at issue ever since in the marriage cases. Mm-hmm. Does the government have a rational basis for treating same-sex couples differently than opposite-sex couples when it comes to marriage? And one of the many interesting things about the Proposition 8 litigation is that the defenders of that state constitutional amendment had the opportunity in court to introduce evidence as to the state's interest in treating same-sex couples differently when it came to marriage. And one of the things that I think is striking about the trial was how weak, empirically, factually, that claim was.
This was in the Romer case.
This is in the Proposition 8 case in California. The defenders of the ban on same-sex marriage in California, after the plaintiffs called a lot of witnesses, of course, the gay couples who wanted to get married, who couldn't, after they called a lot of experts who testify about the real-life impact of being denied the ability to marry, it turned to the defenders of Proposition 8 to introduce evidence as to why we need to continue to have this distinction. And they called really only two witnesses. One talked about on the stand about how gay people are not politically powerless to the extent that the court should not come to their aid, that they can work through the political system.
And that's been a common argument in those cases.
That's right. And then the second argument, but that has nothing to do with marriage, right? But then the second witness did talk about marriage, but he talked in very general terms. He talked about the need to protect the institution of marriage. He didn't talk about actual harms to society that would take place if California recognizes same-sex marriage, as several jurisdictions in the state and the country have done in the last few years. And so the judge, the trial judge in the Proposition 8 case, looking at Romer versus Evans in terms of what it requires legally, concluded that the defenders of the law had not introduced any specific evidence that neither society at large nor particular individuals would be harmed if there was a recognition of same-sex marriage. So under the reasoning of Romer versus Evans, the same-sex marriage ban had to be struck down on federal constitutional grounds.
This is Focus. My guest is Carlos Ball, the author of the book From the Closet to the Courtroom, talking about five cases in the history of the gay rights movement that have set the foundation for the movement and where we are at the moment on rights for gays, lesbians, bisexual, and transgendered people. Phone lines are open, 333-9455, with your questions for Carlos Ball or comments, 1-800-222-9455, or email, available right now, it's a will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a look at the final case that you mentioned in the book that went to the question of sex and the sexual activity and whether that is legal or not. You mentioned earlier a precedent-setting case which had sent precedent in the other way from Georgia, but that was overturned eventually in the Lawrence versus Texas case, which had made headlines a few years ago where the state's sodomy laws were overturned.
That's right. That case started in 1998 when two men were arrested in the apartment of one of them by police officers for engaging in consensual sexual intimacy. It turned out that there was a phone call made by a third party that somebody saw somebody with a gun nearby, and that's why the police officers were there. And when the police officers showed up at the apartment, they found these two men engaged in intimate sexual conduct, which at the time violated Texas law. Texas had a statute which was gender-specific. It prohibited same-sex individuals from engaging in particular sexual acts, and it was a criminal statute that imposed a criminal liability. It was a misdemeanor, fines, but nonetheless a criminal statute. This couple, these two individuals, had the opportunity, were offered the opportunity, essentially to plead guilty and have their record sealed and leave it at that. They spent the night in jail. Were released the following day, and it all could have ended there.
Pay a small fine, be on your way.
And a small fine, exactly, be on your way. But they decided to fight the charge, in particular to challenge the constitutionality of this statute. The case started in the Texas courts. The Texas courts rejected their arguments, arguments based both on equality considerations that we were discussing earlier, but also on liberty considerations under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, arguing that they had an autonomy-based constitutional right to make the decision about with whom to engage in sexual conduct with. So the case ended up going to the Supreme Court, and as you mentioned, the court had this opportunity to really review the prior precedent from 1986. And once again, as the court did in Romer versus Evans, the court very clearly, explicitly ruled that gay people have constitutional rights as well. That gay people are protected to the extent that the state cannot criminalize consensual and private sexual conduct that does not harm, really, in the end, doesn't harm anybody, doesn't involve anybody but the two individuals in question.
And a lot of these, you go into the history of sodomy laws, you know, dating back to the 15th and 16th centuries, in laws elsewhere and then here. A lot of these were written back then to cover not just same-sex activity, but over time, in recent history, I guess relatively recent history, it came to be understood that that was what they were supposed to cover.
Yeah, that's right. Sodomy laws do, in fact, have a long historical pedigree. Most of the American colonies had sodomy laws. But until the 1960s, the sodomy laws in the United States were what we lawyers call gender neutral. That is, they prohibited certain sexual acts, but they did not take into account the gender of the individuals who were engaging in those sexual acts. Sodomy prosecutions in starting around the middle of the 20th century did become quite controversial because of changing social mores. And so what some legislatures did, and Texas was one of them, interestingly enough, starting in 1969, Kansas was the first state to do this, Texas did it in 1973, they essentially decriminalized heterosexual sodomy. And for the first time in the nation's history, criminalized specifically same-sex sodomy. And that was one of the bases of the constitutional challenges to the case, in the case. The lawyers argued it's one question about, there's one issue about whether the state can do this at all, criminalize this conduct, but there's another issue as well, going back again to Romer versus Evans, about whether you could target particular groups of individuals in this way through the use, in this case, of the criminal law.
This is Focus. Our guest is Carlos Ball. From the Closet to the Courtroom is the title of his book. We're talking about gay rights and five cases that have set the foundation for gay rights cases. The numbers to call again, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, willtalk@illinois.edu. Is it fair to say that there may be one of these five cases that could be called most momentous? I know that a lot of these cases intertwine, and a lot of them are cited in new decisions. But is there one that stands out among the others?
Well, I think the case that stands out among the others, and we've talked a little bit about legal issues. But to change the focus a little bit, to talk about social and political ones as well, I really think the case, when you look at it in its entirety, I think the case that has had the most impact is the Hawaii same-sex marriage case. And that isn't to say that legally it's been an important case. It really hasn't, because that was a case that was decided on state constitutional grounds.
And was overturned. It wasn't successful, the end result.
And in the end, the voters approved a constitutional amendment in the late 1990s, 1998, that essentially overturned the decision through the ballot box. That's actually correct. But what I think that case did, and why I think it's really the most important case of the five cases that I talk about in my book, what that case did was make the issue of same-sex marriage, and therefore make the issue or the question of what is the place of gay people in our society relevant and politically and morally relevant to the entire country. And that is that before that case, I think it's fair to say that most people in the United States had never given the issue of same-sex marriage any thought whatsoever. And that includes, by the way, the lawyer, the local civil rights lawyer, who ended up representing these couples in Hawaii. He told me when I interviewed him that when those couples showed up at his office, he's not a gay man, he's a straight man married to a woman with two children, he had never thought of marriage as being anything but marriage, but the union between one man and one woman. And what I think that case did was change the nature of the debate over gay people in our society, not only as it relates to marriage, but as it relates to many other things, including the criminal law, including employment law, including don't ask, don't tell, including family law and adoption. And it has really forced, that case has really forced Americans to take a stand on this issue. Now, obviously, not every American is agreeing with the gay rights movement on the question of same-sex marriage, but at least Americans are thinking about it and are thinking about it from the perspective of civil rights and equality, what equality demands. And so that's why I think, if you push me to choose which one is the most important case, I think the Hawaii same-sex marriage case was the most important one.
And you mentioned the interplay between what's decided in the courts and what's decided by popular vote or that sort of thing. And that's been a criticism of the movement by opponents and others, that they feel that a lot of it has been reliant on individual court decisions, that popular opinion has been, opponents of supporters of Proposition 8 say, majority rules, we pass Prop 8 and it should stand as the will of the people, but they are overturned in the courts. You answer that criticism in the book.
Yeah, there's no question about it that that change that comes as a result of majority votes, whether it's the people voting directly on ballot initiatives or legislators speaking for the people, that there is a legitimacy that comes with that change that is not obviously apparent when the change is judicially mandated. But one of the many wise things that our founders thought about when they were drafting the Constitution was that democracy, real democracy, is not only about the will of the majority. That democracy, properly understood in terms of the values of equality and liberty that are supposed to stand behind that word democracy, require judges to, in some instances, to step forward and say what the majority wants, what the majority has voted for, is inconsistent with our national values of liberty or equality or free speech or freedom of religion, whatever it might be, as codified in our Constitution. So, and that's an issue, that's a question that I think conservative activists tend to forget, or tend to minimize anyway, when it comes to the constitutional rights that they like, when it comes to property rights, when it comes to Second Amendment rights, gun rights, when it comes to freedom of religion, right? That when it comes to those rights, it seems to me that people on the right are recognize the importance of the judicial role or function in promoting and advancing American democracy. I think it is unfair to be rights specific when it comes to criticizing the role of the courts. The courts, you might disagree or might agree with particular judicial rulings, but it seems to me a quintessential judicial function to protect minority constitutional rights against the will of the majority.
We've got about 5 minutes left in the show and a couple of calls. We can hopefully get to them before the end of the show. First on line 4 in Effingham. Good morning.
Yes, thanks for taking the call. I first want to laud WILL and the subject matter of this program, and it is highly important, and it needs to be rationally understood. And the I'm not anti-Semitic, but I use this as a example that when Westerners accepted Hebrew dogma and all that stuff in the Old and New Testament, and then people who choose however they want to about the relationships with others, be that gay or straight or however it goes on, those things are as important as any other part, and I want to thank you for your last statement about democracy.
Do you have a question?
Well, I just a statement. I'm
okay.
Sorry. I should have said that in the beginning.
No problem. Thanks.
But nevertheless, those things need to be addressed as much as the slavery was in its day. And now, with, as you've said, don't ask, don't tell, that's hopefully that'll be resolved. And the continuity of openness and the rights of all of us, no matter what that is, and fitting into this the paradigm of what Western society has become.
All right. Well,
thank you very much.
And thank you for your call. We'll take another call quickly. Let's talk to a caller in Bloomington, Illinois. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for an excellent program, as usual. You pretty much answered my question, but I was wondering if you could tell more about, you know, in general, where the situation stands in the country, given especially the tenor of the country right now, and the supreme makeup of the Supreme Court, and where you think we're going. I am an animal rights person, and I think we're at the very bottom of the barrel. So I'm very interested in what you're doing and other groups. Thank you very much.
And thanks for your call.
Thank you very much for the question. Yeah, you know, in terms of where we're going, you know, I'm optimistic, and one of the things that I hope comes through in my book is that optimism. When it comes to the issue of gay rights, you're absolutely right. The country is in a complicated moment, politically and otherwise. But when I look back over the last 25 years and how far we have come on gay rights, and where and as I look forward and where I think we are going to be in another 25 years, which will be, I think, we will have same-sex marriage throughout the country. We will have a federal law protecting gay people against discrimination.
Is that the end of the line? You know, the civil rights movements for women, other minorities, racial minorities, continues to this day, even with laws.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's not as if, you know, discrimination and unequal opportunity will end overnight. By no means. But the foundation will be laid for the allowing gay people really, in the words of the Supreme Court in Roe versus Evans, mm-hmm. to be true equals in our society. That gets very complicated. You're absolutely right when it comes to actual application. The thing about civil rights struggles is that, you know, they go on. There's no finite endpoint to them. But overall, I think we're moving in the right direction when it comes to gay rights. I think if you look at the poll numbers among young people, even in conservative parts of the country, mm-hmm. They're quite positive. They're quite good for gay rights supporters. And in terms of the caller's interest in animal rights, you know, I think there are spillover effects. Mm-hmm. In the same way that the civil rights movement in some ways laid the foundation for the women's movement and the gay rights movement, the kind of stepping back and thinking a little bit harder about issues of fairness, of justice, about how we treat each other, including how we treat animals, mm-hmm. is an ongoing conversation, and one that I think we are getting better at and not worse at as a country, and therefore my optimism.
All right. We are at the end of the show, and thank you for your time, Carlos Ball. It's been a very fascinating hour.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Carlos Ball's book is From the Closet to the Courtroom, 5 LGBT Rights Lawsuits That Have Changed Our Nation. It is from Beacon.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
We'll take a break for the markets and the weather. Then Carol Spindell will be in, and plants will be our subject in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Futures have a softer tone pretty much all across the complex. Let's look at particulars in Kansas City.